Straight Talk Africa, a look at the significance of the fall of the Berlin Wall and its socio-political impact on African politics. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are discussing important developments that took place on the continent that were triggered by the fall of the Berlin Wall. The Compact with Africa Conference, which promotes private investment by G20 countries in Africa, is underway in Germany. The event is being held nearly a week after Germany marked the 30th anniversary of the Berlin Wall collapse and the end of the Cold War. My colleague Paul Ndiho has more on the story.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel hosted the leaders of 12 African countries in Berlin Tuesday for discussions on boosting investment and trade in Africa. Merkel announced that incentives will be created for companies that decided to invest in Africa.
We believe, and I am deeply convinced about this, that more transparency can encourage more investment in these countries, because for investors from G20 countries, such as German medium-sized companies, it is very, very important that there is trust and that there is transparency, so that it's clear where one is investing and under what conditions.
Germany already has reform partnerships with a number of African nations, including Ghana, Tunisia and Ivory Coast, Senegal and Ethiopia. Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo talks about the African product being sold on the international market.
We've now made the conscious decision that we're moving away from a situation whereby we're just exporters and producers of raw materials, to ramping up the value chain in our own countries.
Germany put Africa and inclusive growth high on the G20 agenda when it held the rotating president in 2017. The European nation addressed the root causes of mass migration from underdeveloped to developed countries. Rwandan President Paul Kagame says that Africa is ready for business.
They are showcasing how Africa is ripe for business, for investment, and how far we can go. For example, the partnership we have had, Rwanda has had with Volkswagen, Siemens now coming in, and SAP, demonstrates the competitiveness of the economies of our continent.
Meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel recently led a series of commemorations to mark the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, which divided the city during the Cold War. The wall was built by communist East Germany to prevent its citizens from fleeing to more freedom in the West. On November 9, 1989, East Germany border guards, overwhelmed by large crowds, threw open the gates to West Berlin, allowing free passage for the first time since the Berlin Wall was built. The momentous event led to Germany reunification a year later and soon the collapse of the Soviet Union. In Africa, the fall of the Berlin Wall ushered in the new hopes of freedom and challenges. In South Africa, the long and hard and apartheid struggle had been gaining momentum nationally and globally. And in 1994, the country became the last African nation to be freed from white rule. According to many historians, the second decade after the Cold War led to democratic progress and setbacks within and among African countries. And even though the number of authoritarian leaders in Africa has declined, there are still some who seized power during the Cold War era and continue to maintain that power. In December 2018, U.S. President Donald Trump unveiled a new U.S. strategy for Africa, combat what was characterized as the predatory practices of China and Russia and their growing influence on the continent. In October, the first Russia-Africa summit was held at the Black Sea Resort of Sochi. It opened a new chapter in relations between Moscow and Africa. Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted the African leaders at the conference aimed at boosting economic ties with Africa. Paul Liho, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Joining us here in Washington is our distinguished guest, Puokule Munyandu, yes, a lecturer in the African Studies Department at Howard University here in Washington, D.C. And from New York, we are joined by Tedla Asfaw, a human rights activist. I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you, Shaka.
You're most welcome. Let me come to you immediately, Professor. What is your immediate reaction to what is happening in Berlin? Germany is hosting a very, what seems to be a very important conference for African countries.
It is. And as we have heard from the preceding report, it follows on the foot of other countries that have held conferences and fora with the African continent, Russia, China, SFOCAC, earlier on Japan, the United States, even India and Turkey. Mm-hmm. So we are seeing a resurgence. That is what this represents, a resurgence in interest on the African continent. But this is a different resurgence from the decade before the fall of the Berlin Wall. This is less ideological. This is more economically based and even less politically based.
More pragmatic.
Yes, some might say.
Very interesting. What about you, Tedla? Your reaction?
Well, I mean, Africans are escorted by outsiders basically for their own economic interest. I don't blame them for that. But we Africans, are we really going to benefit? The people are going to benefit from this economic relation? As far as I know, when Ethiopia's economy was claimed to be in double-digit growth, the poverty, the unemployment didn't go anywhere. So it's depending whom you ask now. So development aid is okay, but if that development is not geared to help the people, it will be a waste of money.
I see. Let me ask you a question, Puokule. How do you respond to someone who will tell you that given the history between the relationship between Europe and Africa, this particular one seems to be a remarkable improvement in that in 1884, you did have another very, very important meeting or conference in Berlin hosted by another chancellor, German Chancellor, Chancellor Bismarck, which defined what actually makes what Africa is today. And in that particular meeting, there was not a single African sitting on the table.
Yes, indeed, and not a single and whose effects, that meeting that is, we still live with today. So we have the separation of Africa from hitherto African city-states, which would be then colonies and which would then be independent African countries along the lines, generally speaking, of these economies. So this is quite ironic that this would be held in Berlin. There is an optimistic perspective to this, that this is Germany's chance to come out on the world stage and be open about its history. So it's a good first start. The world is always benefited by interactions between former rivals and even people that have violated one another in the past. However, it would be best, I would say, if you ask Namibians today what they would like most from this interaction, they will tell you they would like the Germans to issue for the first time, something they've never done, an apology and a reparations for some of the atrocities that they visited upon the Namibian people while they were occupying Namibia. So it's a first start. We can be cautiously optimistic that it's in this, the second step or the third step will involve Germany becoming more open about its past and specific atrocities that it visited upon the African people?
You're talking about the Herero massacres.
Yes, sir. Some have called it a genocide.
Genocide.
It affected, till this day, the population of that quiet and beautiful country. And since their independence in 1990, the Namibians have always been calling for the return of some of the bodily remains of some of these, of their chiefs that were taken to Berlin. So it is, I'm sorry to kind of put a spanner in the engine of merriment as we see such occasions, but it's important to have a perspective and know that beyond economics and politics, there are people's lives and people's histories that we must take into account, and the Germans will be well advised to pay attention to this.
When you talk about the Herero in what is called Namibia today, what about the Maji Maji in what used to be called Tanganyika. And current day Tanzania?
Yes.
The Maji Maji?
Yes, so we're seeing this, it forms a long line, some historians might call it, of real atrocities that took place. We're mentioning Tanganyika because it was once a German territory. And we're seeing Namibia because it was once a German territory. So Germany has a lot of cleaning up to do. There are reasons to be optimistic. The Germans have been quite good at being upfront about the atrocities of the past. For example, they set laws in Germany that it's against the law to deny the Holocaust. Those are excellent steps towards coming into recognizing your past, however bleak it may have been. So I think the Africans, though, would like to see more forthcoming and more bold steps by the Germans.
Tedla, what about you?
Well, I mean, the gentleman is talking about the German African legacy, but we Africans, we didn't even see our own internal legacy. For example, if you take Ethiopia now, there are people, the majority of people, politicians, who believe that they are occupied by some one other tribe. So this mentality of Africans after 1884, their own black people colonize them mentality is what is driving the crisis, the major crisis in Ethiopia. If you ask me why Ethiopia is not stable, because there are people who believe that they have been colonized in the past by Emperor Minili. We have to avenge that. How do they avenge? They have to take all the lands that was their ancestral land to them, so that we can resolve the problem. So Germans, maybe colonizers, they are not there over there. But now if you see the Africans inside our own, one is considered as a settler and one is considered as his ancestors are born there. This is the crisis now the West or China, they are not going to address. We have to resolve this if you want to move and a developed trajectory. Otherwise, I can tell you that what I know about Ethiopia is what I saw in Rwanda in 1994. There are people who are now ready to slaughter their neighbor because their neighbors are not from their ethnic group. South Sudan, we have the same problem. So Africans, we have to wake up and see we are the same people in the same land. Our grievance cannot be addressed treating one ethnic group as a colonizer and one is a colonized. That is a very bad, it is a wrong way, and that will going to destroy country like Ethiopia, Shaka. I have been telling you now, this is a fact what I see in the university colleges where students are sent to learn. They are now killing one another because he is from the wrong tribe.
Your point is well taken, Tedla. Let me come to you again, Paul Okole. If you were to talk to me from the deepest, bitter part of the bottom of your South African heart and soul, is Africa better off today, 30 years ago, yeah, this November, the Berlin Wall, of course, fell. It collapsed. Yeah. And therefore signaled also the end of what was known as the Cold War. Or is it perhaps more of the same?
This is a great question. It's one, I'm just a humble lecturer. It's beyond my pay grade because Africa is so diverse. The question, for example, the comments of my brother from New York, they represent quite a new experience in the minds of a typical South African who doesn't have a problem with tribalism.
Mm-hmm.
So the tribal conflict, for example, that might brother from New York might has outlined that might be rampant in Ethiopia is not rampant in South Africa. So the this diversity of experience also plays into a diversity of memory.
Mm.
There is diversity of memory about what was inflicted post-Berlin, post-independent state, and in the case of South Africa, post-liberation. If you ask a typical South African today, a woman of 45, they will tell what is South Africa better off today or not? They will tell you there are things that need to become better.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be less corruption.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be more accountability at the local government level. But that woman, I'll tell you what, Shaka, if her child is born, that child gets free antiretroviral drugs. So if she has HIV, to prevent a mother-to-child infection for free, that woman will get $500 in an ATM card from the Social Security office to help her with the expenses. That woman gets free diapers.
Mm.
That woman's child will go to school for free in South Africa. So you would be hard-pressed to find that woman telling you that South Africa is worse off today. However, of course, given South Africa's capacity, South Africa can do much better. But I hasten to add that that is a vastly different experience if you took that woman perhaps and put her in Juba, South Sudan. Right? That would be unfair to make those comparisons because this is a relatively new country with very diverse experiences.
Your country, of course, had a very sophisticated, very highly developed economy. And therefore, there are a lot of things that could actually be distributed among the population. Whereas, in fact, when you go to Juba, for example, I don't know whether you have ever had an opportunity to go to South Sudan. There is virtually nothing, or at least when it was part of the larger Sudan, the authorities in Khartoum made sure that they did nothing in Juba.
Well, I think this speaks to then, there is a body of opinion among scholars today. When we see these grand fora, the Chinese have called the Africans to Beijing, the Russians to Sochi, the Germans to Berlin, the Africans. There's an opinion now that seeks to nuance these fora, that what South Africa might be going to this Berlin conference to get is vastly different from what a Kenyan or a South Sudanese will be going to get.
Correct.
That is why it's very difficult to be able to address what Africa must get from these conferences or fora when Africa is so vastly divided in experience and opinion and even governance styles. Some Africans, for example, the Rwandans, have made a pact that they will accept an authoritarian leader.
Have they?
Well, by the looks of things, they have. The leader has been democratically elected for the last, let's say, more than 10 years. So the Rwandans have, at least the Rwandans that vote, have decided that there is a constellation of values that we associate with liberal democracy that they are willing to forego in order to gain a certain economic stability.
Paul,
this is not new among the nations of people.
Paul, how can you talk about a democracy whose election results do not reflect the will of the people, but in fact reflect the will of the individual that announces the results?
This is a very good question. This is a question that will be best answered by the Rwandans themselves. But what we see then, this informs us the fact that we can ask why is there ostensibly, from the looks of things, a relatively stable country. That some people come, some Africans might be tempted, is my point. Some Africans, when they look at Rwanda and they come back, even South Africans, a minister went to Kigali and came back and said, the Minister of Finance said, Kigali is so clean. You know, So some people look at these things and start wondering, some countries, that, well, what are these constellation of values that the Rwandans have forsaken or have basically put in the corner in order to achieve socio-economic advancement, rapid economic advancement? And it's tempting for some people, not for South Africans, but for some countries.
The last time I checked, when you talk about stability, what is stability to you really? Is it the absence of war? Is it the absence of violence? Or is it perhaps, as some people suggest, the presence of social, economic, political justice for all?
That's a great question, Mr. Dr. Sali. It's all these, and it depends on who you're talking to. If you're going to 2012, South Sudan, stability is the absence, the cessation of violence. To be able to sleep and wake up and not fear for your life. Mm-hmm. But if you talk to a South African, or you talk to a Namibian, you talk to a Cote d'Ivoirian, stability means having three meals, but more than that, having a job because you're qualified to get it, and not having a relative of someone get the job before you. That's stability. Stability is an aspirational goal amongst people, that the people themselves define what it is. So in South Africa, stability is to be able to have a car or two cars in South Africa, to have a house that has electricity and running water. That is a far cry from perhaps what stability might be in Chilomoni in Malawi.
Very interesting. Tedla, what about you? Do you agree with the good professor here, or do you have your own version or variation of what you consider to be stability?
Well, let me say that what we call stability now in Ethiopia is, if you are going to go out and come back, if you ask stability for a parent in Ethiopia is whether his son or daughter is coming back after school, or is that he's going to get a dead body. So for us, it is serious now. We are not even talking about electing who is the next prime minister or is a parliamentary member. Stability at this moment in Ethiopia is a survival. Will you be alive or dead? If you have such perception in any normal country, I don't know how you function. So he's right. The stability is depending on whom you ask in Africa. But basically, when I see the Rwandan Prime Minister Kagame, his country was on fire 25 years ago, and now his country might be quiet. People are just have been told to just do their business. They might not be involved in politics. So there is this kind of stability. So I wonder if maybe what they call it, some benevolent dictatorship, is good for Africa. I'm starting questioning now. If you ask me, if you have a fear for my life, well, then maybe I mean he's saying that, oh, if I have a good dictator, maybe I can sleep, wake up in the morning, and I will still hope. That's the mentality I have now in my country, Ethiopia. It is really sad to say this.
What about if you tap a little bit into history, and we're talking about world history here, not necessarily African history. We're looking at, for example, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, which became the Soviet Union. We're talking about 1917, I suppose, led by people like Lenin and, of course, Joseph Stalin and what have you. Don't you think that the Soviet Union and, for example, Joseph Stalin was stable? Didn't it enjoy a remarkable degree of stability until its collapse in 1991?
Well, let me be honest with you, Shaka. When you call Soviet Union and Joseph Stalin, one thing which Stalin is known for, that without Stalin, without that huge war, we could not have been even what we call Europe now. So such dictatorship in one way or another has defended many lives. So it was not a democracy. See, now when the Soviet Union crumbles, we are seeing in 30 years, we see a lot of things. We see The white supremacists are coming open in the public. Most of the victims are, I remember, African students who were studying in Soviet, in Russia. They were beaten up in Germany. Those African students were kicked out. So nobody was touching our African students during the Soviet time. They were at least learning and going back to their home. But now I cannot tell you what they are in, but I'm not sure. I'm not living there. But it is depending to whom. If you ask what was Soviet Union for fellow Africans, it was nice, free education. They got everything free. And now that might not be the case. But what am I arguing is this so-called question of stability in Africa has to be seen from all angles, but it depends which African country are you talking about. As the gentleman said, for Rwandans now, it is not about stability. For them is being a magnet for like a high-tech country. I see Rwandans are going ahead with intelligence research stuff like that. That is not the case in most African countries. Don't ask South Sudan and don't ask some African countries. So I do believe that dictatorship, that the so-called benevolent dictatorship, has also given good stability for many people in the world and in the past. And it might give now even for us, some African countries, I can tell you that.
Do you agree with Tedla? Because if you basically agree with him, then it would seem to me that if you go to some of these long-term African dictatorships, they may have probably enjoyed or are enjoying stability.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Essentially,
there is
no
such a thing as a benevolent dictator. Well, and that this benevolent dictator, in fact, uses power as a force for good.
Well, I would say, look, freedom is the irrepressible cry of the human spirit. Most people want to be free, to be able to pursue whatever it is that pleases them.
The right to have, at least for an individual, to have the right of owning an opinion.
Indeed, indeed. And the right to buy what you'd like at any time and not have bread the prices of bread be decided by a committee of people. To be able to live where you'd like and not have a committee of citizens tell on all your comings and goings. So I think certain experiences, especially since we're talking about the fall of the Berlin Wall, certain experiences of the Eastern Bloc countries, certain experiences certainly of some of the African countries that had fallen under the Soviet influence or Soviet bloc, would probably dispute this idea of a benevolent dictatorship. If you speak, for example, to Tanzanians about the success of Ujamaa, they will tell you that, well, we know that the Africans are demonstrably, unlike the Chinese who succeeded in collectivization, basically you are born here, you go, all of a sudden you're in a camp and you're all together and you're happy.
Did Ujamaa in fact succeed?
Demonstrably against this. Well,
is it your view that Ujamaa succeeded? Because there are a lot of scholars who will tell you, including Tanzanians, that it was a remarkable failure.
That's my point. It was a remarkable failure. It's that if you ask the Tanzanians today, there's a consensus that it failed, that Africans tend to not like to be told where to live. And that is the essence of freedom, you see.
Despite the fact that Mwalimu Julius Kambarage Nyerere was a remarkable leader, a man who was not a thief, a man who was not a murderer, not a con man, a man who meant well, and where it was possible, actually admitted his mistakes.
And that is something, that is why we remember him today. Because he left, upon the failure of the Ujamaa project, he left it to people like President Mwinyi, President Mkapa, President Kikwete, who have tried, and the Tanzanians are still trying. But the lesson of this...
And here we have John Pombe Magufuli.
Yes, sir. But the process is, human beings like to be free. You cannot have a restriction of freedom. And as a South African, I'll tell you that in South Africa during apartheid, you could drive a Mercedes-Benz You could drive a BMW, you could have a refrigerator. My neighbor had a Chevrolet car.
You could do the same in the United States under Jim Crow.
That's right. So, but if you ask my mother or the South Africans, was it nice or not? They would say they would give all that up to be free to walk wherever. Some of your viewers who have been to South Africa, they will know this. If you've been to Cape Town, you've walked in the waterfront. If you've been to Johannesburg, you've walked in Sandton. If you've been to Durban, you've walked in the beachfront. Before 1990, a black person was not able to walk where you walked. And if you ask a South African whether they would barter that for a benevolent situation where the economy is guaranteed one way or another, they will tell you an emphatic no.
Unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. And so on that note, you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them, today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies.
Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known.
It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, South Sudan's president and chief opposition leader have postponed the formation of a unity government for another 100 days. The United States is re-evaluating its relationship with Juba. Inside the political turmoil in South Sudan, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
And today we are discussing Africa after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Our guests are here in Washington, Puokule Munyandu, a lecturer at Howard University, here in Washington, D.C., and from New York, Tedla Asifaw, a human rights activist. Well, gentlemen, again, I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
It's good to be here with your viewers.
Thank you.
You're most
Thank
welcome.
You, Shaka.
It's always a pleasure interacting with you guys. Let me ask you, Tedla, there is a saying that if wealth is gone, nothing is gone. That if health is gone, something is gone. But that if character and integrity are gone, everything is gone. Now, the question is, when you look at the African leadership today, where is the African character and integrity?
Well, Shaka, you bring the good question now. You know, our forefathers, I can tell you that, the Jomo Kenyatta, the Nkrumah, Haile Selassie, they did one thing. They said Africans can rule their own, we don't need outsiders. They said no to colonialism, and they gave us Africa. 1960s, most African countries were free. We've established the Organization for African Unity. If you ask me the character of those leaders at that time, they were really honest people who believe they can guide Africa through their wisdom, and they tried their best, and they gave it to the next generation, African Union generation. What did you do, the African Union generations? Basically, we failed. We failed in many, many areas, except, I mean, the South Africa, the black Africans' freedom is the major thing. That is, everybody is proud of that. We don't take that from the new generation of Africans. But now, where are we, the Africans? If you ask me, millions are now sent across the continent as a refugee. If you see who is now suffering, who is not eating daily a bread, is an African. So if I am an African leader now and going to world meetings with a nice tie and suit, what do the other people say that? They see me as a weak person, as a weak leader. A guy who is not fixing his house is not going to be respected by time. So people see us as who we are, as Africans. Some they say these corrupt African leaders, we can do business with them. So character-wise, we don't have no Mandela now. If you ask me, one person now who will be a symbol of Africa, I can tell you that I cannot name any name. So who are the best leaders in Africa who are really saying, walk their talk? I cannot say there are none, but most of them are not a character which are going to give us for the next fight to develop Africa, be prosperous. And I want to tell to my brother, I'm for democracy. I'm not saying that we have to be in dictatorship to develop. I didn't say that. I'm not thinking that. But there are no leaders who are now be a symbol where they can be leading by example. Our character is worldwide known. African leaders, we don't have respect. Whenever we go, African leaders, they found protesters wherever they go. So that is sad. The character-wise, we failed miserably, and that we cannot hide it anyway.
Very interesting, Pokre. There was a time, for example, Tedley is saying something that is very important and relevant here, because there was a time in African history when you could really identify some founding fathers who really meant well, who were visionary, and who were not defined by the boundaries or the borders in which they were managing their affairs.
Yes.
You could talk about, for example, the Osagyefo, the man from Nkroful, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. I remember on March 6, 1957, when he essentially became the first black African country to regain political independence from the British colonialists. This man actually said, he challenged the Ghanaians really. It was not just about celebration. He said, the independence of Ghana would be meaningless unless it is linked with the total liberation of the rest of Africa. And Pokure, he did not simply talk the talk. He actually walked that particular talk, so that African countries like yours, South Africa, which was under apartheid, like countries which were called Rhodesia, now Zambia and Zimbabwe, those countries eventually became politically independent because of the vision and, frankly, the work of people like Kwame Nkrumah, people like Zambian founding president Kenneth Kaunda, people like Tanzanian founding president Julius Kambarage Nyerere, people like Sekou Toure of Guinea-Conakry, people like Colonel Gamaro Abdel Nasser, people like Ben Bella of Algeria. What happened? There is often a saying that in society, the young people follow their elders, that they can actually step on the shoulders of the elders, and that if they happen to do that, they have an opportunity to see a little bit further. What happens? How come there is no such a thing as continuity in Africa? Especially a person like you who comes from South Africa, a country that got what one could call independence, really, in 1994.
Yes. Well, I would say that since we're talking about the fall of the Berlin Wall, yeah. While the rest of the world was living under the euphoria of the triumphalism that followed the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was a different story for South Africa, as you've outlined. And so, in fact, some of the worst aspects of apartheid would precede the fall of the Berlin Wall. The death of 24 people in the Bishop massacre, 50 people in the Boipatong massacre, and so on and so forth.
It would precede it.
It came after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So the South Africans were, in effect, spared the euphoric effects of the fall of the Berlin Wall, because the hardest part and the most violent aspect of apartheid were yet to confront them. But back to the historical perspective you outlined, I think it would be interesting to note that the vicissitudes of the time, they did have an effect on these leaders, because many of these leaders didn't rule for a long time, but they left us with powerful images of what a leader might be. To be fair, as fair analysts, we must then judge them on that account, that many of the leaders didn't finish their terms, or they didn't rule as much as they would have wanted to. Some of the leaders had one-party states, an aberration in today's Africa, if you're an African supporter of democracy or multi-party democracy. So there was also at that time something we must remember. There was still this negotiation that Africans were undergoing between advancing the cause of other countries' freedom, as far as Ghanaians would be concerned, and having a one-party state. Or Tanzanians, in the case of Tanzania, you know, the one-party state as well. So there's always a negotiation we must always keep in mind, that that things are not quite as they seem. There's always a negotiation between values and aspirations. And the Africans have not ceased to have this negotiation. Now, the different ways in which this manifests itself might be different in our days. There is an economic aspect there, and there are various players in what we call a multipolar world in which we live. But at the time, it was a bipolar world, and the vicissitudes of the time had their effects, and we know how their rule ended. So they left us with an image.
Bipolar, there was the West and the East.
Yes, sir.
Now, when you talk about the West and the East, when you look at the fall of the Berlin Wall, it seems to me, for the most part, at least in Eastern Europe, it seems to have translated into what we call democracy.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
And how come it translated into democracy in Eastern Europe, which was, like Africa, a beneficiary of the one-party state? And yet, for the most part in Africa, it still is, in a sense, a sort of one-party state. You have, obviously, on paper, or you have, in theory, multi-party politics.
Yes.
But when you actually become very serious and you become realistic, that multi-party politics or system is pretty much based on the one-party state template.
Yes.
You have, for the most part, those countries, frankly, where there is no separation between the party in power and this thing called the state.
Yes.
The government.
Yes.
The two are fused. Why?
Well, I think we might ask, for example, the Cameroonians why. Because if you look at the Cameroonians, President Biya has been there, I think, even before I was born. And so he's seen the Berlin Wall fall. He's seen a bipolar world. He's seen a unipolar world. And most likely he's going to continue to see a multipolar world. So this, we might want to ask, it would be interesting to ask the Cameroonian people what basically necessitates that they tolerate such a rule when other African countries might not. And that is the importance of having a nuanced view of Africa. Because what the Cameroonians might be ostensibly happy with, the Namibians will not be, certainly not the Botswana of the beautiful and stable country of Botswana, which is quite a story to write home about when it comes to good governance.
Yeah, definitely. But when you talk about Paul Biya in Yaounde, he might feel a little bit uncomfortable and think that you are perhaps being unfair because there is the champion himself in neighboring Equatorial Guinea, Theodore Obiang Basongo, who has actually been in power since 1979
yes.
after having assassinated his uncle.
I think we're being unfair.
Was undemocratic.
Yeah, we're quite we are being unfair to the Mr. President Obiang Nguema in this instance, because we are fair to actually Cameroonian President Biya. Because why? Because in that is one unsavory aspect of democracy, Shaga, that we must engage with. There are certain aspects of democracy and rituals, elections, having an electoral body, doesn't matter if the person is actually happens to be in your pocket. But African leaders like Paul Biya have actually gone through these rituals. They go through them every 5 or 10 years. So if you ask Mr. Biya,
elections, or are they in fact which some pundits refer to as selections? Where an incumbent president organizes an election he cannot afford to lose.
Well, that's for him to answer that. But at least we now see then that African leaders have certain African leaders have perfected the ability to play the game of democracy. That, and then Mr. Shaga, brings into sharp focus this idea that is kind of gaining ground. That seeing that some African leaders can say, I'm a Democrat and rule for 40 years, why not then we take the benevolent authoritarian leader? At least we are able to get developmental rent from this leader. The trains are on time, so to speak.
Yeah, well, if that's the kind of person you are talking, I hope that you are probably referring to the likes of the late Lee Kuan Yew, of Singapore, or the Matia of Malaysia.
Oh, so bad my health. And the Malaysians
have come back.
Yes, yes.
At more than 90 years of age.
Yeah.
Because his people, in fact, believe in him.
Yes.
But what about the people? When you think about it, when you go to African communities, you find that people have integrity. People have character. People understand the concept of fairness, of justice. But when you come to those people who control this thing called the state, the government, and by the way, they are supposedly educated, in that for the most part, they have actually been beneficiaries of modern Western education. They talk, they can define democracy in so many different ways, and yet, they are not.
Yes.
How are we going to make the ordinary African become socially and politically conscious or aware of his role in society so that he can be in a position where he has the right and legitimacy to choose the people who can govern him?
Well, an optimistic perspective would be that in a world where there is a phenomenon we call African Twitter, there is Nigerian Twitter, Kenyan Twitter, South African Twitter, in a world where there is WhatsApp, you can have a group of people. In a world then where someone who's poor in Kampala, but if they get their hands on a Huawei phone, which is relatively cheaper, they can get into WhatsApp and form a group and agitate for change. And no matter and they can get a VPN if the government tries to shut it down. So this optimistic perspective holds then that there is reasons for hope with a young, vibrant, connected youth that is unable now. It cannot be held back by the borders of the countries. So it can learn and take notes on ways to agitate for change.
In tandem with perhaps social media?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So, and this, it's very difficult to control social media. And what this does, the youth in Cameroon are able to take notes on ways to agitate, ways to organize from youth in South Africa, from youth in the south side of Chicago, without the without the government being the interlocutor of this process, because that is where the problem begins. Even when you have free election, but if the government is the interlocutor in the by choosing who the electoral commissioner is going to be, choosing how the election is run, then make the choice the Africans might, but they're making the choice within the parameters that are already compromised. The internet and the proliferation of social media, even some might say artificial intelligence in the future, is going to be for the benefit of the upward-looking youth of Africa, because it will connect them to others and they'll learn best practices for their own upward mobility without the government.
Tedlai.
Yes.
There is a saying that all of life is about passion, action, and reaction. And that to ignore the passion, action, and reaction of your generation is to risk having not really lived at all, is to occupy space. Is it possible that the vast majority of Africans are in fact occupying space? That is why we are where we are, despite the enormous wealth that the continent commands.
Shaka, I wonder, I don't know if I got your point very well, but what I am seeing right now, you said it before, ordinary Africans are very passionate people, and there is no animosity when they do business, when they do trading, when they do everything. The ordinary Africans, I see them are doing their business in a normal fashion. You don't even to lecture them how to live. Very wisely, they live with each other for generations. What we do now is that when you bring in democracy in Africa now to capture power, it becomes the ideology is no longer socialism and capitalism. It is tribalism. So, if Africans, for example, in Ethiopia, we have 80 nation, small nation, and whatever you call it, different languages, whatever. We cannot create 80 parties. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. So that means we have to compromise. How are you going to compromise? By respecting everybody. For example, is it in American system? You have the Congress and the senators. We can do such kind of things even for the small tribal areas. We could give them equal vote of power to manage their business in the politics. If we try to formulate that structure, we might really destroy this tribal politics. One says that I'm have a majority number, so I'm going to rule over you. You cannot do that in a diverse continent like Africa. Tribal voice doesn't allow you to dominate the other group. There should be a balance. So I hope if we structure, if we formulate structurally this type of government to run smoothly, I can tell you, Shaka, Africans are very good people. They know how to live. They are very smart people. Because let me tell you, when I talk to diaspora here, whom I say hello on the street? If I see fellow Africans, I say, how are you, brother? This is how we communicate. I don't ask from which country. Later on, I will ask him, are you from this or that? But as an African, I treated him. Why on earth, on our own land, Africans, we don't see each other as the same people? If someone comes from Nigeria to Addis Ababa, he comes to his home. If I go to Lagos, that should be my home. So let us try to, you know, this tribal politics, we have to manage it somehow if it gives fruit. But for Africa, my fear is that the tribal politicians are taking our people in the wrong way to benefit their own interests. They don't even have their tribal interests, I can tell you that. They don't do any, build any small road to their people, I can guarantee.
Thank you, thank you. What we know, of course, is that they are patriotic to their stomachs, the stomachs of their families, and friends, not society. Let me ask you this question, the good professor. You know, most reasonable people think that democracy is the way to go. Without democracy, you cannot really talk about bringing equity, bringing really social justice to society. Any particular reason why a lot of African rulers, not leaders really, but rulers, somehow have something against democracy because they say it is an alien ideology, that is something that is not essentially from Africa, that is from outside Africa, and therefore it is not good for Africans. And yet, the last time I checked, for example, when you talk about energy, you talk about electricity, for example, you know that the bulb was probably invented by a man called Thomas Edison in Rochester, New York. He's a white man, Mzungu. These same dictators, same rulers, they don't have any problem switching on the lights. They enjoy the light. How come they do not complain that that light was invented by a Mzungu, by a foreigner?
Well,
they enjoy the telephone, for example. Mm-hmm. Well, the last time I checked, the telephone was also equally invented by an American, Alexander Graham Bell.
Yes.
In fact, his grave is in Albany, New York.
Well, that sometimes might be an unfair comparison because it's the same way we also enjoy paper money, which is in yours and my pocket right now. Even if you hated the Chinese, you'd still use it. The same way if you have a gun, you enjoy having a gun, even though you hated the Chinese and with their gunpowder. It's not the problem to have interaction among human beings.
But democracy, that is how human beings have lived. Democracy is the most important infrastructure. Is the foundation that benefits all of society. Yeah. When you talk about telephone, you talk about electricity, you are talking about superstructures here.
Well, let's first, I think the starting point should be livelihood, developmentally, how human beings live lives of dignity. The extent to which democracy in an African country post the Berlin Wall's fall gives people dignity, human dignity, the ability to live your life happily, to be free of rape if you're a woman, to be free of cronyism and so on and so forth, is the extent to which the democratic experiment, and let's remember that democracy is always an experiment. Even in America, it's an ongoing experiment, never perfect, but it's the best one so far.
It is a work in progress.
So the extent to which you judge democracy, that is why it's important as scholars and analysts to look at people and their livelihood. And people's lived experiences will tell you how successful their experiment has been with democracy.
But frankly, do we really have to learn from any other culture about fairness or justice? I mean, these are essentially values that are part of African society.
They are. They really are. But I want to encourage interaction among people. Because no matter how much people don't like one another, we always have something to learn from one another. I mean, look today. Japan and South Korea, they don't like each other right now, and they've since not renewed their intelligence sharing agreement that they have. Why? Because they are squabbling over certain differences about a certain agreement made about comfort women ages ago to other people. But to them, this is a very important thing. But they haven't stopped trading with one another. They haven't stopped having tourists among one another. Interaction is what's important. It's not who's learning from who, but how beneficial the interaction is.
Well, unfortunately, time is not our best ally, and on that note, our distinguished guests today were Piwokule Munyandu and Tedla Asifal. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.